Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
This will certainly have an adult theme and might well contain strong scenes of sex or violence, which could be quite graphic. It may also contain some very explicit language, which will frequently mean sexual swear words.
What do you like listening to?
Chart music.
Chart music.
You pop craze youngsters, and welcome back to part 3 of episode 67 of Chart Music. Here I am, Al Needham. There are my friends, Taylor Parks and Neil Kulkarni, and we are not in the mood to fanny about. So, forward and Payaka, Manango, and then go Saka.
They put away their combine harvester, and now I want to introduce you to Farmer Bill's Calamon, and here are the Wurzels.
It's an hard life when you're working on the farm. Down on the farm, I don't need no alarm. I rise from me bed at 5:30.
After we get to contemplate the overhead lights for a couple of seconds, we return to Tony, who warns us that it's ooh-ah, time. And then, out of nowhere, the two members of the next band who don't look like a kindly Fred West hove into view and whistle in his ear. It's Farmer Bill's Cowman by the Wurzels.
At last.
We chanced upon the Wurzels in Chart Music number 35, where they trotted out their prize number one single, Combine Harvester, in the 1976 Christmas Day episode. Dead lambs being shoveled into plastic bags, etc., etc. This single, a cover of I Was Kaiser Bill's Batman, the single recorded by Whistling Jack Smith, which got to number 5 in April of 1967, is the follow-up to Give Me England, a self-penned single where they go around Europe and aren't impressed because they don't have Scrumpy or Bingo. Realising their mistake, they reverted to the winning formula of taking a well-known tune and fermenting it in a still, and put out this from their latest LP, also entitled Give Me England. It's not in the charts yet, but the BBC fucking love the Wurzels for reasons we'll go into later. So here they are in the studio. That's the only bit of interaction Tony's had with anyone so far in this episode. Why do you think he's being kept away from the kids? It is around about this time that the Top of the Pops presenters get a bit more isolated, don't they?
Yeah, they usually start off on their own in their little fortress of solitude, and then over the course of the episode, they're gradually reintroduced to society.
Yeah, like a Godzilla film, isn't it? It's just the same. Godzilla's always on his own. And then about an hour in, Godzilla's surrounded by a load of kids and he's introducing the Wurzels.
Well, I mean, as we'll see later, there's a bloody good reason Tony's not allowed near the kids at the moment. Mm. Yeah, as we'll see later.
The Wurzels, chaps, it's easy to forget, but they were fucking massive in 1976, 1977, weren't they? A cursory skim of the newspapers of the era reveals the following article from the West Britain and Royal Cornwall Gazette. Headline: ooh ah, 'tis strange how folks go for Wurzels. The merits of the pop group The Wurzels and The New Seekers were discussed by members of Kerrier Council's Amenities Committee last week. Mr. Ashley Hawley, Deputy Manager of Carnbree Leisure Centre, said the centre made a loss of just under £900 on the New Seekers concert. Mr. Jim Hamm asked how the sale of tickets for the Wurzels concert, due to be held on Saturday, were going. Mr. Hawley said that nearly 1,000 tickets had been sold. Why can't the new Seekers create local interests like the Wurzels? Asked Mr. Ham. It was suggested that reports that one of the new Seekers' girl singers had left might have put people off. Mr. M.J. Gale said his daughters were not interested in the new Seekers, but were going to see the Wurzels. It was just a matter of choosing the right people to appear. I think that is the most granular I'll ever get on a bit of research. Fucking council meetings from nearly 50 years ago, everyone.
Well, they were massive. And the thing is, you could not avoid them, especially in the year of
no
characterful dads. You know, here they are. And the thing is, yes, even if they stopped having chart success, as they soon do, it doesn't matter.
No.
They've got the Basil Brush show to go on. They've got Cheggers Plays Pop to go on. They've got all the Summertime and Seaside specials. So there's just so many shows that they can fill in on. And that's why they're kind of a big part of 77. But they're certainly a big part of my memories of this period, because they were just fucking everywhere.
You're right, Neil. People are turning out for that Somerset sound, even when the Wurzels aren't appearing. Here's another article, this time from the Lichfield Mercury, a fortnight from this episode, entitled A Night for Some Wurzling. Pop group The Wurzels have obviously had a great effect on Lichfield people. Out of about 300 people who attended Longdon Cricket Club's Wurzel Night at Seedy Mill Farm, at least 60 joined in the spirit and went dressed in smocks and other rustic gear. The Grand Wurzel Night was inspired by the Wurzels, famous for their country-style-inspired versions of pop songs, and the evening went with a Somerset swing. A challenge to sing a Wurzel song was not taken up, but there was a prize for the worst-dressed couple. The event was in aid of club funds.
So this is people turning up, even though the Wurzels aren't going to be there in any way, shape
exactly
or form. That's mental.
It's incredible,
it's just
isn't
it? The concept of the Wurzels has drawn them there.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
They're like living Wombles at this time, aren't they? And this summer, this puts a tin lid on everything. The Saffron Walden Weekly News reported on a visit at the local Baptist church by two strolling gospel minstrels who performed a Wurzels hit with rewritten lyrics entitled I've Got a Brand New Holy Bible. So, yeah, it's Wurzel time, man.
It is. I mean, this song, Farmer Bill's Cowman, this performance. I mean, this is golden era Wurzels, isn't it, really? Before the joke has worn completely thin. Which it does fair. I mean, I think it probably reached its unfunniest nadir on the I Hate JR and I Shot JR singles.
Yes.
But this is the Wurzels I remember. I don't remember the Adge Cutler years, and I don't think I ever caught an episode of the great Western musical Thunderbox, because it was only on HTV. So,
of course.
So this is the Wurzels I do remember. This kind of permanent Turonis sketch of a band.
Yes, aren't they just?
I mean,
just.
It's just a permanent preemption of Spinal Tap Sex Farm, and I'm astonished to learn that they covered that.
Yes, extremely well. It's a fucking great version. But yeah, you're right, Neil. You know, life after Adge Cutler, that makes the Wurzels the new order of the late 70s, doesn't it? So, the single, as we've pointed out, it's a rewrite of a hit that kids didn't give a fuck about, which is good. Mm. And as always, they lean heavily on imaginative reinterpretations of the lyrical motif, ooh-ah. In the last single that made the charts, I Am a Cider Drinker, they went for Ooh-ah, Ooh-ah, Ray, which does sound to me like a West Country paramilitary organisation. Yeah, the provisional Ooh-ah, Ooh-ah, Ray have claimed responsibility for the tractor bomb outside the Woodpecker factory last Saturday.
The silage bomb.
And this time they've opted for Ooh-ah, Ooh-ah, Ah, which sounds like something Scooby-Doo would say to Shaggy when a Frankenstein was lumbering up behind him. So, not as good, but, you know, still good enough. As a kid, Neil, what did you think of this?
Well,
you've already laid your cards on the table, re Brigass and Rastrick. I'm assuming that you'd like this.
Well, I did like this. I mean, I liked the Wurzels anyway because of their cartoonish kind of aspect. I mean, their faces are like they're drawn by Hanna-Barbera. They do have this horrible habit, in a way. A lot of comedy records do this in this period, that they've got, in a sense, thieve contemporary culture and blend it in, if you like. Do you remember of that kind of comedy music that just uses everything. In Combine Harvester, I seem to recall there's an ad lib where he goes, "Who loves your baby?"
Yes.
And it's kind of this
during the performance.
Exactly, yeah.
Not in the single.
Yeah, yeah. But On Top of the Pops, yeah, certainly. I remember that Kojak ad lib. And here, in this performance, I think they nick John Inman's line from Are You Being Served? I think there's a moment where they go, "I'm free." I fucking hate moments like this. Mm. But they have pushed at this period completely beyond local fame. I mean, it's astonishing when you look at those old singles, Drink Up the Zyder.
Yes.
It sold like 100,000 copies in the West Country or something insane like that. But
mental, isn't it?
At the same time, though I enjoyed their appearances on all the different shows that they were on, they were pretty much on all the different pop shows, you can sense already here that they're running out of songs to parody, really, aren't they?
Yes.
So, the writing's on the wall, but I would have loved this being on.
I mean, the lyrical content, as always, is an uncompromising an examination of rural life. So there's scatology, violence, alcoholism, sex, and yes, bovine homosexuality.
Yeah.
Pete Bug gets so pissed up on cider that he milks a bull, does a bit of Simon Bateson on it, and that bull gets turned. That's what the I'm Free thing is about.
Total joke would have gone over my head, I reckon, as a kid.
Not me. I got it straight away. Your heritage is Hindu, isn't it?
My heritage is Hindu, yeah.
Would fundamentalist Hindus be offended by a record where a bull gets wanked off?
Yeah, they probably would, you know. I mean, you know, over there, it's nuts. In Mumbai, you know, if a cow is walking down the street, as they do, and just sits on its arse, you can't do anything. The cars have to avoid it, you know. You can't move it on. Very, very, very holy about cows. And then when the vegetarianism kicked in with my dad, couldn't have beef burgers for 4 years, man. I was gutted.
Oh,
yeah, no, this might not go down well in India, particularly now with the Hindu fundamentalist nutters in charge. So,
Pete Budd would be floating in a world of shit and piss and spunk when he dies.
And toenails. And snot, pretty much everything else.
Well, there was a diversion.
Yeah, certainly. Didn't expect to be talking about that. But the audience reaction is kind of revealing in a sense. I think, you know, it's only little kids who are going to be digging this. There's a handful of kids amused here, a hell of a lot more totally unamused, just stood with their arms crossed.
Yes.
So, yeah, the writing's on the wall. It's going to be over soon in a chart-topping sense or in a chart-crushing sense. But there's still going to be a going concern for several years hence. In kids' imaginations and on Crackerjack and everything that they could ever appear on.
Indeed. Taylor, in you come. Come on, tell me some Worsley stories.
Yeah, well, I mean, if you got 100 people at random and you ask them, who's your favourite pop group of all time? I think most of them would probably say Anderson, Bruford, Wakeman, Howe. But if you then ask them, who's your second favourite group? Undoubtedly, almost all of them would say the Wurzels. Because even today, these icons of Britishness make all of us feel so proud of the landscape and traditions of our country. I mean, you know, that's a joke, right? They're about as good an advertisement for the British countryside as Straw Dog. But there's a kernel of truth there. You know, when you go into the British Museum and you walk through all the galleries of like ancient art and artifacts from all around the world, and there's all these perfectly smooth jade amulets on leather chains and glittering bird statuettes sculpted from solid gold with sapphires embedded all the way around. And then you go into the room with British stuff from the same period, and it's like some mud with a stick in it. Do you know what I mean? Like, a sign saying early British figurative art, and it's a bit of rock with a parsnip for a nose. You know what I mean? I mean, it's not our fault. It's because it's so cold and wet here. You just have to concentrate on survival. And once we'd invented buildings, we managed to catch up. But there's still something in the British psyche that will revert to that when under stress. And, you know, in its way, with its mixture of cowpat-brained simpleton primitivism and slick showbiz, this is a form of authentic English country music. You know, give me England, indeed.
Yes.
I mean, yeah, I mean, it's like if the Troggs had been shit.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, it makes me a bit sad because I used to really feel the countryside. You know, I lived there for a bit as a kid and it was really in me. I used to feel nature deep down with a really intense and, yeah, almost inexplicable seriousness.
Nature boy Taylor Parks.
And nowadays it's just something I see in the distance from trains passing by. You know, it's like looking out of a window at youth or social democracy. It's like familiar, but far away, made into flats, you know. So yeah. I sort of thank the Wurzels for reminding me of what it's really like and why I shouldn't go back. You know, here we are, it's Jubilee Week. Professional serfs.
I mean, at the time, I'd have been well up for this. I didn't know I was Kaiser Bill's Batman, but I fucking hate that tune. It's just proper Carnaby Street cat shit.
Yeah, my mate hates that more than anything else in the world.
You're good.
Late night, they used to show repeats of Beat Club, and there's that clip of whistling Jack Ketch on Beat Club doing this, and it's not even him whistling on the record. No. It's just some bloke dressed up in like a guardsman's outfit. My mate, his steam used to come out of his ears at how smug this guy looked, considering he's miming to "I Was Kaiser Bill's Batman." It's not even him.
No, I can't hear that tune without seeing that fucking mini with Zoom written on the side. You know what I mean?
Yeah, well, and those blokes picking out Red Guardsman's jackets off a rail. Yeah, yeah.
But yeah, you're right, Neil. They are practically full-time BBC employees at the moment, aren't they? They've been on Swap Shop. They're regular guests on the latest series of That's Life. They're on Seaside Special, Ken Dodd's World of Laughter, Ronnie Corbett's Saturday Special, Cabaret Showtime, The Basil Brush Show, Sunny Time Saturday, regular guests on the Radio 1 Roadshow, and, of course, Top of the Pops. And, you know, while I was watching this, I started to think, why the words? Why are they on BBC all the time? Well, let me take you back, chaps, to 1972 when Johnny Beerlin, the controller of Radio 1, was on a camping holiday in France and he chanced upon a mobile variety show on a stage that was towed from site to site on the back of a lorry. And when he returned back to work, he set about doing a wholesale nick of the idea, but then he discovered that the BBC didn't have anything suitable in their garage to put it on with. So he cast around looking for advice and he ran into a producer from BBC Radio Bristol, who put him in touch with a chap called John Miles, not the Music Is My First Love hit maker, but the manager of a local band who bought an old furniture van and amended it so it could open out into a mobile stage, which was then taken to fairs and festivals.
Right.
And when Beerlin got in touch, he was told that the van had already been sent off to the knacker's yard because it kept breaking down, but he'd be happy to build another one on the condition that Radio 1 had rented out for the summer. And after he made them a scale model of what he wanted made out of Weetabix boxes, Beerlin gave his approval. So Miles located a suitably sized chassis, did a drawing of what he wanted, and he gave both to a local coach builder and let him get on with it. And the result was a portable stage that was able to be towed around the country by a Range Rover, which was driven by his brother, Tony, or Smiley, if you will. And yeah, that's how the Radio 1 Roadshow came about. And would you happen to know the name of the band that Miles managed? Yeah, the fucking Wurzels, mate.
Really?
I see.
Because the BBC looks after its own, doesn't it?
Indeed. It all makes sense.
Anything else to say about this?
It's always a bit glum when you look at a band's official website. You start at the news section and the most recent story is from last year and it says one of the band's died of COVID, although he was 80.
Yeah.
I'm sure at his funeral they led his empty horse with his wellies backwards in the stirrup.
Yes.
But in the lyrics section, they include the words to this song.
Right.
Right.
The first verse of which ends, "Out in the pen, there's a broody old hen. She is as wild as a tiger. You try to touch her egg and she'll bite off your leg. I feeds her on faggots and cider."
Yeah.
And depending on your worldview, it's either a good, bad or hilarious thing that the Wurzels have felt the need to put an asterisk next to the word faggots, leading to a footnote which clarifies faggots, a dish of chopped liver, etc., made into balls, lest any of the woke snowflakes misconstrue these lines to mean that Pete Budd entraps homosexuals and feeds them to his carnivorous hen. It's just helpful. It's like the little pride flag, you know, and just to keep, but except that the very next verse goes, I felt such a fool, tried milking the bull.
Yes.
He must have enjoyed it somehow, man. Mm. Now every day at three, he comes and says, I'm free. That's why I'm Farmer Bill's cowman. It's every red-blooded hayseed's nightmare. Accidentally pulling on a bull's penis, him liking it, and it making him a gay like John Inman.
Yeah.
Fucking hell, can you imagine? Oh, I only got half a bucket of milk, but it weren't half creamy. Ooh, oh, yeah, I love drinking that bull spunk. I mean, it's an occupational hazard, isn't it, I suppose?
It floats on top of your tea, man. It's not good.
I think, us being the ATV land people, we've got a natural kind of predilection towards this stuff to a certain extent. Because, you know, our accents are a mix of West Country and other stuff.
Your so, accents.
Perhaps so. But, yeah, there's a little bit of Uwanus around here. I'm very close to, like, Worcestershire and places like that, and it's on the downward slope towards that area. Mm. And, you know, faggot and pea batches are very, very popular around here in a rich West Country sort.
Yeah.
So, you know. I've always wondered what a West Country sauce is.
I think Taylor's just described how you do it.
Maybe so. But, maybe that's why I had a sort of slight affection towards this. But, yeah, I must admit, I've been moaning about characterful dads. There is something deeply unpleasant about the way Tony introduces this record leering looks on the faces of the Wurzels as they practically pretty much nibble his ears.
Yes.
It's pretty gross, isn't it?
They're whistling in his ears. I can't remember the names, but the one who looks like a Partick Thistle defender and the other one who looks like Rennie's dad.
Yeah, Tommy Banner and Tony Bayliss. That's the two red shirt Wurzels, basically.
Yes.
Yeah, they converge on Tony whistling, and he backs away.
He looks absolutely riven with pain.
What, he backs away grimacing.
He reacts as if they've just started whistling the theme tune to Robin's Nest.
Well, what it's meant to be, he backs off grimacing to suggest that they stink, right? Like they got bad breath.
Or they're horrible.
I'm just saying, we know that unlike Richard O'Sullivan, Tony couldn't act. And that is a very convincing halitosis recoil.
It was a really good introduction because they hove into view and Tony kind of like withdraws. And then all of a sudden, Pete Budd rises up from under the screen, pointing into the distance. It looked brilliant. I do like Pete Budd. He does look really friendly. He's got a lovely voice as well.
Well,
he is like an older, more rural Dave Bartram, isn't he? They've got that same kind of bell-shaped haircut. Yeah.
Well, the secret of the Wurzels, I think, is their believability.
Mm.
I mean, everyone concentrates on Pete Budd, the leader of the Wurzels, because he looks like a Beano drawing come to life.
Yes.
But the whole band are genuinely unnerving. Right. Any one of them away from the stage, you could imagine meeting on a rural walk and it would be just him standing there smiling vacantly next to another bloke who does all the talking, who looks at you suspiciously and he's holding a shotgun. Yeah. And he says, occasionally cocks his head towards the Wurzel and says he don't much care for newcomers. Sometimes he forgets his manners. I'm thinking here mostly of Tony Bayliss, nature's cruelest and most powerful mistake. He crushed a tender young bloom in his fist. But it was his way of loving. It's terrible, though, isn't it? You see the Wurzels here, and they're all rosy-cheeked smiles.
Mm.
Yeah, but, you know, chances are one barren autumn, one moonless night round the back of the grain silo. Shoot the dog first. Goodbye, my lovely. Bang. And leaving a scene of carnage back at the farmhouse, and then it'll be 12 bore in the mouth, no hesitation, and he'll decorate the galvanised steel behind his head with the valueless jelly that he'd been keeping in it. And somewhere in the distance, there's seven new people born.
There is a slight terror of the countryside, which is part of the Wurzels' appeal, I think. I mean, they're hearing a big smoke, but yeah, but you don't know the darkness that they're going back to. I think that no, but that is part of it. The West Coast, I mean, I spent about a weekend recently in East Anglia, which I've never been to before, and it was spooky right. as fuck. The countryside has always terrified me, but this, you know, the East Anglia is particularly terrifying. But this is it. Who knows what the Wurzels are going back to exactly. Where, you know, the West Country was... I'm not saying it was a mysterious zone, but it did exert that kind of mystery to it. Whenever I got down to Devon or Cornwall on holiday, it was a bit spooky. And the Wurzels keep that in their faces, basically. You don't see faces like that in the city. They could only be born in Somerset or from that area. So, yeah, there is that slight darkness to what the hell are they going back to once their pop business is done in the big city appearing on Top of the Pops. You know, that long drive back to Devon. Their farmsteads and homesteads, all of that still spooks the shit out of me. And they are realistic. They're not city boys dropped into farming schmocks. You do sense. No. That much as, you know, most burgers that you have at Glastonbury have animal feces in them, these guys probably have got a bit of shit on their shoes. You know, there's that realism to them, which I think appeals.
It was terrible. By the time they found him, his neck stump had been licked down to almost nothing.
Yeah, they're spinning a total myth about the bucolic lifestyle of the farm. Because about a year from now, our class in junior school gets took out for a trip to the farm. And of course, Wurzel's songs got sung on the coach. And, you know, there was kind of like great anticipation amongst the youth that although we might not see the Wurzels there that day, we were going to see people just like them in smocks and pitchforks. But, oh dear, those illusions were totally shattered when we got there to realise that everything fucking funked and animal shit. And it goes without saying that there were no Wurzels or Wurzelikes in attendance, just some chunky blokes who looked absolutely fucked off about being stared at by some junior school council cunt. And my teacher thought it'd be a great idea to take a tape recorder and hand it round the kids so we could record an oral diary of the day, and he played it back to us the day afterwards, and what was heard on that tape was me refusing point blank to walk through a barn and then dry heaving and fighting not to cry when Sir dragged me through it. And then us looking at some cows in a field and one of them rearing up and landing on the back of the other, and Michael Hall shouting, "Ah, sir, look at them cars bumming."
Bummer cow.
Yeah, bummer cow. And the tape concludes with us standing next to the pigsty, which was properly rank.
Oh, God, yeah.
By this time, you can hear on the tape that I'd absolutely fucking lost it. Now, this is the era of Prince the Dog on That's Life, and you can actually hear me manhandling the tape recorder off some youth, going up to the pigs and shouting, "Sausages! Sausages! Sausages!" And by this time, I'm lying completely face down on the desk with my arms over my head, totally shamed up, and I've never been to a farm since, so yeah, thanks, Wurzels.
No, I mean, and the realities of the farm are something that the Wurzels don't really talk about. Their idea of farming, it's not the brutal, inhumane, agri business that is actually going on, you know.
No.
Which would probably lead to entirely different type of music.
Yeah, it's just getting pissed, moving some shit from one end of the barn to the other, and then getting kalide on Scrumpy and trying to get your end away.
That sounds appealing, whereas, sounds, I don't know, appealing. Having a job where you get a box of freshly hatched chicks and throw them into some machine that destroys them, you know, would lead to, I don't know, some proto-industrial murk in the mid-70s, I guess. But, yeah, the world wasn't ready for it.
Ah, you're a bunch of soft city boys.
So, 2 weeks later, Farmer Bill's Cowman entered the charts at number 45, then entered the top 40 at number 39, and a week later got to number 32. Its highest position. The follow-up, a tune for their favourite football team called One for the Bristol City, failed to chart, but they went back to the formula and put out a cover of the Pushbike song called The Tractor Song, which also failed to chart, and this remains their final appearance on Top of the Hobbs.
Oh, probably for the best. Just a warning, by the way, to the pot crazy youngster, do not seek out the B-side to the Tractor song Funky Farmyard.
Oh, it's so disappointing, isn't it?
It is. It's just not funky in any way whatsoever. Disappointing.
No. Yeah, I was expecting a bit of Bill Oddie style.
Yeah, or a bit of, so what's that Meters track? Seahorn's Farm or whatever it's called. Yeah, yes. Something like that, but no, it's resolutely unfunky.
No. After trying once again to do a bit of Euro bashing with I'll Never Get a Scrumpy Ear in 1979, and then jumping on the Dallas bandwagon with the double A-side I Hate JR, I Love JR in 1980, they got all urban in 1983 with Wurzel Rap, but all failed to chart. Have you heard that?
No, I avoided it. I did see it, but I just thought...
Video playlist, everyone.
Yeah, I'll check it out.
However, they resurfaced as a student union act in the early 90s, and a re-release of Combine Harvester got to number 39 in November of 2001, and their cover of Don't Look Back in Anger got to number 59 in December of 2002. Neil, Jesus.
Of course I'm bloody...
I bet it's better than the fucking Oasis.
Possibly, I mean, presumably they've adapted the lyrics in a Wurzel style-y.
No.
It's just a straight cover.
Yeah.
Why the fuck would I want to do that to myself?
After putting out Make Hay Not War for the Stop the War movement in 2003, they went back to basics with a re-recording of I Am a Cider Drinker with guest vocalist Tony Blackburn, which got to number 57 in May of 2007. They're still active today and share the same manager with which other band?
Ooh.
White House?
The Stranglers.
Oh. Blimey!
Neil?
Yeah?
You know what I'm going to ask?
I think I do.
Something about the catering.
The Wurzels or the Stranglers? Who would you have a sandwich off?
Oh, man. I mean, they're both gross. But, yeah, with the fear of genuine fecal contamination from the Wurzels.
Bread all soggy with cow placenta.
I think I've got to go Stranglers.
Wow. Mm. Fucking hell. You've got to consider, though, from the Wurzels, he's going to be farm fresh.
Yeah, but farm fresh is often gross, to be honest with you.
With that West Country sauce.
Yeah, I'd have brains faggots in a West Country sauce off the Wurzels, so long as they assure me that they're just putting it in a microwave. Anything that they've touched, no, they're farm folk. They don't know cleanliness.
Neil!
No, you know, it's the country way.
I feel so apologetic to our rural...
No,
your stomach hardens to that stuff after
this is
a few
it.
Years.
This is
bacteria
it.
Bacteria just die like dogs in there.
Yeah, my aircon in my car, right, is fucked. So when I was driving through the countryside on my way to Norfolk, of course, I was hit by those gusts of chicken shit and pig shit. You know, the really bad stuff. And, you know, because my aircon's foot, there's no point closing the window. So I just had to, you know, brave it. But these countryside folk, you know, you just get used to it, don't you? They are completely inured to that stuff. So, you know, during sandwich preparation, who knows what the fuck will be going in there? Who knows whether they've cleaned... Oh, look, I'm not saying everyone in the countryside is a dirty, disgraceful bastard, but... The Wurzels are committed rural folk, and I'd be dubious about proper contamination from animals, animal shit, basically. So, although the Stranglers are grubby bastards as well, I don't think they've got, pigs in their back garden or anything. So, got to go Stranglers, I'm afraid.
So, pop craze youngsters, if you read in the news about a cow being thrown off a bridge onto someone's car on the outskirts of Coventry soon, that'll be Neil.
Pitchfork, I tell you. Just have a look at this. Guess who it is? You're absolutely right. Gladys Knight and the Vips, and this one called Baby Don't Change Your Mind.
Tony, alone again, naturally, decides to turn the show into an episode of Who's Baby, as we see a photo of a toddler who's so obviously the front woman of the next group, followed by a photo of her and her mates with Ed Sullivan, as he finally introduces Baby Don't Change Your Mind by Gladys Knight and the Pips. We covered Gladys, A Brother Bubba, William Guest and Edward Patton in Chart Music number 18 when they took Midnight Train to Georgia to number 10 in June of 1976. Since then, they've been a steady presence in the lower reaches of the top 40 over here, but this single, the follow-up to Nobody But You, which got to number 34 in January of this year, written by Van McCoy and the lead cut from the LP Still Together, sees the group sniffing the wind, recognising the gamey tang of disco and scampering after it. It entered the charts a fortnight ago at number 33, then soared 11 places to number 22. This week it's only nudged up one place to number 21, but no matter, because here is the video.
I really like Tony's link here where he says, I'll be watching what he does with that pitchfork, I'll tell you. Because although it's not a very clever or funny remark, it does make you think how incredibly exciting and memorable it would have been if Tommy Banner had actually leapt off the stage, pushed through the audience and rammed his pitchfork up Tony Blackburn's arse, causing Tony to throw back his head and scream with pain. So both prongs of the pitchfork emerged, tearing through his exposed throat and showering the cheering audience with blood and tissue. And Tommy Banner whispers, "You was right to worry, young'un," as he performs a unspeakable pagan rite on the body. And up in the gallery, they're getting calls telling them to cut the feed, and Robin Nash is screaming, "Don't cut, don't cut, we're staying live, this is sensational stuff." And at home, Tessa Wyatt is watching it with Richard O'Sullivan, and they're both laughing. Anyway, that's what Tony was worried about. I think he needn't worry quite so much.
Have you been watching a lot of Italian folk horror movies of late, Taylor?
Well, no more than usual.
So anyway, this video, it's 70s video cliche number two, isn't it? The band having fun in the studio. Even though the entire film is just set in a massive couple of boxes, you still got that American vibe off it. And, you know, by this time, 1977, any bit of film about America, even if it's just a studio, is thrilling.
Oh, without a doubt.
To the youth, isn't it?
I mean, by American standards, this is actually kind of a budget video, you know?
Yes.
But after the Wurzels... Yes. Oh, my God, what a magical other world America looks like.
Yes.
I mean, I love this song. The Van McCoy production tilts them towards disco, like you said. It's not wholeheartedly disco yet, I don't think.
No, it's getting there, isn't it?
It's getting there. And it keeps the Motownness and the soul, and it's just a great track. And fundamentally, I mean, as ever with black American pop from the 70s, I'm not saying CMP contributors have to stand down in a sense, but it's tricky because the sense of relaxation that happens with American artists when a camera is pointed at them is just totally different. British bands in a video like this would feel the need to prove their relaxation by sort of gamely sort of grinning along, but Gladys Knight and the Pips, they just have it. They're Gladys Knight and the Pips, for fuck's sake. And good on them, really, in a way, for sending a video, because I think by now the Pips and Gladys had twigged sort of just how odd the British are. I think it would have been that they kind of always dressed down a little bit for their TOTP appearances. And I think, you know, it would have been frankly undignified for them to follow the Wurzels.
No.
So this video is a delight, but it's accompanied for me watching it with a sense of, Christ, what to say about this, because it's just wonderful. It's just a wonderfully produced record with a great little budget video with it as well.
Yeah.
Luckily, this was before anyone had heard of homosexuality except the Wurzels. And it was unexceptional, and it's only mildly fabulous to see grown men with moustaches wearing tennis shorts and dancing in formation and doing exercises together.
Yeah, with the T-shirts all rolled up and everything, exposing their midriff.
Yeah, socking each other on the arm, no doubt. Yeah. Talking about the ladies when Gladys is out of the room.
I love those shorts.
Yes. Those Jimmy Connor shorts are really strong, as Taylor said, highly camp look.
At the beginning, we see them kind of like doing a bit of a dance routine, being taught by someone standing behind them in a vest. And they do look like they're about to go roller skating afterwards, aren't they?
Yeah, but they look like they're having so much fun.
Yes.
Yeah. And like nobody that age, or nobody who looks that age, ever has that much fun without a bit of an edge on it. Do you know what I mean? But the Pips look like they don't have a care in the world. Only blue skies for the Pips. Yeah, and Gladys looks really cool in her sportswear as well. Mm. And it's a shame because then she gets sort of frumped up a bit for the main bit, you know, where they're in civvies in the studio and all that. Whereas the Pips, you're kind of grateful when they're back in the slacks.
Yes. You know? Mm. Yeah, I mean, to a nine-year-old like me, it was obvious that being Gladys Knight in the Pips was the fucking best DOS in the world. They have a bit of a sing, then they have a bit of a dance, and then, you know, there's a couple of blokes lingering in the doorway watching on, and then we cut to the other side of the glass and there's two blokes behind a mixing desk, one of whom is the absolute dead spit of Ron O'Neill in Superfly. And they're watching Gladys Knight and the Pips perform and they have a bit of a chat to each other. I mean, I don't know what they're saying, but it's bound to be words to the effect of, fucking hell, this song is mint and on our live skill.
Yeah.
And they've got the best headphones in the world.
Oh, these yes.
Massive red headphones.
Yes.
But, and I don't know whether they've been told to hold the headphones in a certain way, because they all kind of hold, not over their heads, but kind of under their chins.
Yes. Like a giant telephone.
Yeah.
The kind of phone that Busby had on top of that telegraph pole.
Indeed. But they're instantly, deeply covetable, these objects, these red headphones. They really catch the eye. But the whole look of it, it's just instant. You're propelled to this magical land called America.
Mm.
And after the Wurzels, fuck me, you need that.
Yes.
I mean, they're on the way out here, really. Mm. They've got one foot in a chicken basket.
Yes.
They got a couple of sunset hits ahead.
Yeah.
But that's about it. Mm. I mean, this is sort of their last hurrah. But this is so great.
Yeah.
It's just it's one of those records that sounds like it came off a production line in the best possible way.
Yes.
You know, like everyone involved knew exactly what they were doing and just did it without any fuss, you know. And it's another one of the few 1977 records that I think I remember from the time as well. It stuck in my head because of that moment where half the instruments drop out on the chorus and the vocal melody is doubled by the string section, which is a trick they used to use on a lot of American records at the time, just underlining the hook. We talked about the same thing on Silver Lady by David Soup, I seem to remember. But it really does weld a chorus onto your brain.
Yeah.
And the chorus sort of needs it because it's not an especially strong tune, but it sounds heavenly because it's done with that effortless American sophistication and gloss which 70s British records could never replicate.
No.
You know, British records could do cold dry strings in a way that you would never ever hear on an American single, which is brilliant, but they also could never get that brimming over pearly gate sound that you get from Philly soul and late 60s early 70s Motown and stuff like this.
And these moments are important in any episode of Top of the Pops because they're just transportation away.
Exactly.
Midway through this song, you know, you've forgotten about the fucking Jubilee. You've forgotten about Top of the Pops and Tony Blackburn, to be honest with you. And you know, you're completely immersed in it, so it's magical there.
And it's the first bit of proof in this episode that there is life after Motown for a lot of acts.
Yeah, as we're going to see again later.
So the following week, Baby Don't Change Your Mind jumped 7 places to number 14, and 3 weeks later got to number 4, its highest position. The follow-up, Home Is Where the Heart Is, got to number 35 in October, and they'd make their last appearance in the top 20 when Come Back and Finish What You Started got to number 15 in August of 1978. That's a fucking tune.
Very much so, yeah.
By which time, the group had fallen out with their new label, Buddha Records, and were forced to record as two separate entities until their deal ran out. They eventually signed a new deal with CBS in 1980, but the hits dried up over here and they parted ways in 1989.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Well, there you go. You're probably wondering what this little bit of string is here. Well, I'll tell you what will happen. If I pull this bit of string, two things will happen. First of all, some balloons will fall down on Neil Innes, who will then sing a number, Silver Jubilee. Let's see if it works, shall we?
Queen Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, Silver Jubilee. Queen Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, God save you and me.
Tony, standing next to a tatty bit of string, tells us that when he pulls it, some balloons will fall down from the ceiling and the next act will do their bit. He does, and by God, we're thrown into Silver Jubilee by Neil Innes. Born in Danbury, Essex in 1944, Neil Innes was a fine arts student at Goldsmiths in the early 60s when he joined the Bonzo Dog Dada Band, a rotating collective of art school sorts who took the piss out of trad jazz cover versions in local pubs and college balls. As the only trained musician in the group, he whipped them into some semblance of a band, and they made their TV debut playing Won't You Come Home, Bill Bailey on Blue Peter. They signed a deal with Parlophone, but after the success of the new Vaudeville Band, a group of session musos put together to record Winchester Cathedral, the Bonzos were invited to inherit the name for a tour, which they all turned down by their trumpet player Bob Kerr, which gave Innes the opportunity to convince the band to drop the old stuff and steer them towards the new sounds of the mid to late 60s. On December the 23rd of 1967, they became the resident band on the new Thames Television kids show Do Not Adjust Your Set, which introduced them to Eric Idle, Terry Jones and Michael Palin. And 3 days after that, they appeared in the Beatles film Magical Mystery Tour on BBC Two. After myriad TV appearances and a string of sessions for John Peel's Radio 1 show Top Gear and a punishing gig schedule, they finally made it big in late 1968 when Urban Spaceman, written by Innes and co-produced by Paul McCartney, got to number 5 for 3 weeks in November. After touring America in 1969, they decided it wasn't any fun anymore, and they split up in January of 1970. And Innes and Viv Stanshall spent the early 70s in bands such as Freaks, with Keith Moon on drums, and Grimms, a collaboration with members of The Scaffold. And he also put out his debut LP, How Sweet to Be an Idiot, in 1974. Later that year, he reunited with Idle, Jones and Palin as a fill-in of sorts for John Cleese in the final series of Monty Python and wrote songs for the film Monty Python and the Holy Grail. In 1975, he and Idle starred in the BBC Two sketch show Rutland Weekend Television, which featured a song called I Must Be in Love, which was performed by a band called the Ruckles. By 1977, he's working up a film script and a soundtrack for the forthcoming Ruckles film, All You Need Is Cash, and has just put out his second LP, Taking Off, this April. But while being interviewed by the BBC World Service, he was challenged to make up a song on the spot about the Silver Jubilee, and this is it. It's been rushed out by his label, Arista Records, and it's not in the chart yet, but Robin Nash is clearly looking for a hook to hang his oversized Jubilee hat on, and this will do very nicely, leading to Innes' first appearance on Top of the Pops since he wore a ball gown to perform Urban Spaceman nearly 9 years ago. And oh, chaps, we're instantly thrown into the Top of the Pops of 1982, aren't we, without the Zoo Wankers? I mean, if Michael Hurl had been asked to organise a National Front demo, it would probably look like this, wouldn't it?
Yeah, this almost cancels out the Ruckles. I mean, obviously the key factor, the main characteristic of this record, and also the main problem with it, is that you watch it, and even if you're very familiar with Neil Innes and his work,
yeah,
it's impossible to work out how it's meant or how you're supposed to take
yeah.
it.
Yeah.
Because clearly he's not hailing the Queen with an expression of murderous intensity.
No.
But it doesn't sound like he's having a go either.
No.
And as usual, he's just standing there looking underwhelmed, a little sheepish and incorrigibly morose. So you won't find any clues in his facial expression.
No.
And generally, broadly in favour of not being able to tell how sincere somebody is on a record
yeah.
because it allows discussion and it encourages you to think a bit. But here it's a bit annoying.
Yeah.
And I mean, yeah. a big part of Neil Innes's aesthetic and the Bonzos and to a certain extent Monty Python is this sort of baffled, ironic, mildly alienated distance from the world, which creates this kind of perpetual satire, but at the level of a lack of seriousness and an inability to be po-faced about anything, which people never tire of pointing out is a very comfortable middle-class old world way of seeing things, because you don't have the complication of any of those things being a direct threat to you, even though that wasn't the background of everyone involved in those groups, but it was the reality of their lives. And in the context of comedy, that can work very well. You know, like the best satire of the ruling classes tends to come from the children of the ruling classes, or used to. But I'm not sure it works so well in a song, because this isn't comedy, it's just whimsy. Yeah. And so all the protections and defences that comedy has just fall away, and you're just left thinking, yeah, but what are you doing? Yeah. It's like your half-raised eyebrow as you sing a deliberately trite song about the Queen's Silver Jubilee suggests that you don't really care either way. No. Perhaps you don't dislike royalty, but you're aware of the silliness of the whole palaver. Mm. But it doesn't work, even as a sort of dryly equivocal take, because you're doing it right here and now in this context, which tips you over into unironic celebration, because that's the way the current is moving, and you've decided to step into the current and not swim.
Or his record label's decided he's going to do that.
Oh, yeah. But the end result is there you are on TV waving a very small Union Jack.
Mm. And it's kind of upsetting. I mean, it's fucking shit, this record. I don't like the equivocation of it. But I mean, you know, I do think, I mean, Innes is a great hookmeister. He can knock out a pop song. I mean, I know he said he did this as a bet, but fuck me, we just did not need this.
Yeah, it's a bet that we lost.
He does great cod reggae.
Yes.
You know, if you listen to the section about medieval open field farming systems in Monty Python's The Background to History, he does great cod reggae. And I guess some of the rhymes here are kind of pleasing, you know, saluting with highfalutin and that. But I mean, I love Neil Innes, but this, you know, he was part, actually, Neil Innes, sidetrack, of one of the best gigs I've ever seen. I went to see Yola Tengo at Warwick Arts Centre once, and they had a couple of guests on stage with them. One of them was Sonic Boom from Spaceman 3, and the other one was Neil Innes, and he was wonderful. He was playing their together songs. He was also playing Spaceman 3 songs. He even did Urban Spaceman. But this is surely an idea. I mean, thinking of ex-Bonzos, if you want a picture of class at this time in British society and culture, probably dig into Viv Stanchel's Sir Henriette Rawlinson's End LP that comes out I think, the year after this. Maybe the film from 1980. But Taylor's exactly right. That there's this equivocation in this song. Is he taking... He's not quite taking the piss. Mm. You know, at any other time, I guess I'd tolerate it, but in the thick of the Jubilee, it's a time to call sides, in a sense. And he hasn't done so.
No.
And I don't like seeing Neil Innes do this, because I like Neil Innes a lot.
Yeah, I mean, you'd see how this would work on the end credits of Rutland Weekend Television or the Innes Book of Records, where you can actually control the visuals. But here on Top of the Pops, he can't.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the crowd's frenzy and the flags and the balloons and stuff do not help it. They make it look like he is, in celebration, whereas the lyrics are a little... You know, more nuanced than that.
And he's not dressed up either. I mean, if it had turned up dressed as the Queen, that might help. But he looks very Paul Simon, doesn't he, in his dress? He's got this baggy suit jacket on and a white flat cap.
Yeah.
And, of course, we've got the heavy-duty discipline at the top of the Pops Orchestra.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Well, the cap is to hide evidence of a hair transplant.
Oh, right.
Unfortunately, he was the donor.
Right.
The thing is, it's not surprising that this is where Neil Innes has ended up, sort of. Kind of almost sort of celebrating the Queen, because spiritually a big part of his work was a kind of melancholic distrust of progress. And you know, he was like Terry Jones out of Monty Python. He liked natural things and old stuff and, like, you know, real ale and things. He was distrustful of anything too organised or too cerebral or too manufactured. And in his Book of Records is full of that, all this sort of little man in the modern world, you know, retreating into magic and imagination, which can be lovely, but in the wrong context, it can easily seem reactionary, or at least in sympathy with a reactionary position.
This is the first time he's been on Top of the Pops in 7 years. It's like, oh fuck, where's the Dolly Birds on the gantry? Who are these kids?
It is weird, isn't it? And there's not many other performances on Top of the Pops in this period that I can think that are, and not the performances, but the crowd dynamic, that are quite like this. You're very right to point out that it's prophetic of kind of an 80s Top of the Pops in a way.
And it's unbelievable that none of them Ruckel songs charted, because they were fucking brilliant.
Yeah, he never made a penny out of any of them, of course.
Yeah, but he did make a ton off Oasis for them ripping off How Sweet to Be an Idiot, along with Gary Glitter.
Yeah.
Good old Noel giving a paedophile £1 million. Well played, mate.
Yeah, I tend to prefer Neil Innes's collaborative work to his solo stuff, partly because that sort of vague whimsy and distracted sweetness doesn't really do that much for me. Like, he was brilliant in the Bonzos because he provided the platform and the guardrails for Vivian Stanshall, you know, and he was great working with Monty Python because of his grasp of the detail of music and what sounds like what and what should go where to create this or that effect, right? Which went brilliantly with Monty Python's least discussed superpower, which was the incredible eye for the detail of, for instance, English archetypes or styles of television presentation. Like, people forget this now because TV doesn't look like this anymore, but in 1969, 1970, Monty Python's parodies of TV looked as uncannily, almost unbelievably precise and accurate as the day-to-day did in 1994. So when they added music to that, they needed someone with the same observational skills. And it's like, it's like Neil just mentioned, the best bit of Monty Python's Matching Tie and Handkerchief LP is that sketch, which, if you haven't heard it, the only joke is that it's like an open university broadcast or like a highbrow radio lecture about the medieval open field farming system. And they introduce various eminent history professors. Professor Tofts of the University of Manchester put it like this. And each one sings their bit to a different kind of pop tune. And there's a reggae track, a glam rock track.
Rural.
Sort of.
Framework.
And so it's just an obviously contrived Palin and Jones sketch where you put two incompatible things together so they spark and undermine each other's seriousness, and then the sketch writes itself. But it's not even a funny idea. It's only funny because of how convincing and well-judged and well-observed Neil Innes's music is. And it sets up Michael Palin as the professor of medieval studies at Cambridge doing an uncannily accurate impression of a stoned rock star being interviewed on the Old Grey Whistle Test, which is possibly his greatest ever acting performance. But the point is, there aren't any jokes. It's just playing with formula and context. And Neil Innes, one of the very few musicians you could trust to get all of that precisely right, which you need to, or the whole thing dies, and it's just not funny.
Yeah.
You know, which is obviously also why he ended up doing the Ruttles. But his own material, I mean, the only song of his that I like, you know, or that I love, let's say, in that sort of slightly sad, whimsical style, is How Sweet to Be an Idiot. All the other songs of his are like a dead straight, you know, the Ruttle songs. And, you know, I watched the Innes Book of Records a few years ago, and God bless him, it dragged a little. I didn't like it as much as I really wanted to. Because, again, a lot of it is stuff where you can't quite work out the point or what he's trying to do, which should be interesting. But too often, you just end up with the impression that actually there is no point. And he's not really trying to do anything at all. He's just singing a song, which, you know, it's fine. It's fine. But this is not a pretty sign.
No. Sailing on the yacht Britannia, no one in the world would ban you. Well, I can think of a few pubs on the Falls Road that might have issues with that. And nowadays, a few schools might turn a son away.
Yeah, it's a line that's been left behind by time a bit, hasn't it, that line?
So, the following week, Silver Jubilee failed to chart and never would. The follow-up, the Bob Dylan pastiche protest song, also failed to chart, and he never troubled said chart ever again. 2 years after this performance, he returned to BBC Two with three series of the Innes Book of Records, a collection of music videos of his own songs, and then spent the 80s as the host of the ITV kids show The Book Tower, played the magician in Puddle Lane, and wrote and narrated the cartoon series Raggy Dolls. And he died in 2019 at the age of 75. Dolls like you and me, don't you know? Made imperfectly.
Queen Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth, Silver Jubilee. Queen Elizabeth, Queen Elizabeth.
Well, I hope you're all having a really lovely Jubilee week. We're having a fabulous time here at Top of the Pops. Hope you're enjoying all the music. We're going to change tempo a little bit right now. We're going to have a bit of that sort of bit of rock for you now in the shape of the Stranglers. And this one.
Tony, still in his realm of solitude, suddenly notices that the camera's on him again, and he expresses his hope that our Jubilee week hasn't been a crushing disappointment ruined by your dad constantly going on about how Elvis is the fucking king. He then warns us that a change of pace is imminent and tells us we're going to have a bit of that sort of bit of rock for you, because he can't even bring himself to say punk.
Yeah, that's exactly what's going through his head.
Yes. Yeah. To Tony Blackburn, but saying punk is as good as saying fuck.
Yeah, it's sedition. You can't say punk.
No.
But that's exactly his thought process. He's, I mean, and as ever with Tony, not hiding his disgust.
He introduces Go Buddy Go by the Stranglers. We've dealt with the happy-go-lucky, squeaky-clean former Guildford Stranglers on numerous occasions, and this, their second single, is the follow-up to Get a Grip on Yourself, which got to number 44 in March of this year and should have done better were it not for the British Market Research Bureau, the compilers of the official chart, somehow mistakenly taking a chunk of the Stranglers' sales and lumping them onto Everyone's Talking About Love by Silver Convention, he said, placing his hand on his chin. It's actually a double A-side with Peaches, which features on their debut LP Ratus Norvegicus, which came out in April and is currently at number 7 in the album charts. But seeing as the subject matter is about Hugh Cornwell dossing on the beach looking at women's arses, and the cover of the single depicts a hand pulling at the back of a pair of pink knickers that have been put on a peach, Radio 1 forced them to put out a radio edit and don't want it on Top of the Pops. It entered the chart 3 weeks ago at number 37 and only nudged up one place to number 36 a week later. But that didn't stop Top of the Pops from issuing an invite as long as they played the song On the Other Side, which involves Jean-Jacques Burnel encouraging his mate to stop being a wallflower at a club and get stuck into all the punky crumpets and being delighted to see him with a chicky on his knee at the end of the song, which helped it jump 9 places to number 27. This week it's moved up four places to number 23, and here's a repeat of that performance a fortnight ago. Chaps, let's deal with Peaches first, because to my mind that's the far superior song.
Yeah.
The only thing about it, it reminds me of that HP Sauce advert that Frankie Howard did with the couple in the seaside postcard with a fat bloke with a tash perving on women while his wife doesn't know it. Oh, HP, you've got to admire their sauce.
It would have made for a better Top of the Pops appearance.
Yes.
Imagine
Legs and Co. doing
that's
that.
Exactly what I was about to say, yeah. Legs
probably
and Co.
dressed up as giant peaches. One of them dressed as a massive banana running round after them, no doubt. Played by Dave Lee Travis.
This song is less good. It's interesting, though, this. I mean, listening to the demo of this song from 76.
Right.
Because before, the Stranglers even got signed, they demoed this song. And it's totally different. It's like a slower pace, a sludgier sound because it's a demo. But you can at least hear an attempt with the hand claps and the harmonies on it to sound, I don't know, professional.
Yeah.
It's kind of been professionally scuffed up.
Yeah, it's been punked up a bit, hasn't it?
Yeah, because of punk completely, much like the whole band has. There is a deliberate fuck you amateurism to their performance here.
Yes.
Because they swap instruments and they take all the strings off their guitar. And,
yes, I was wondering about that.
I think it's JJB, isn't it? It's playing guitar. Yes. And other fellas playing bass, and he's playing quarter U. Yeah, that's right. He's playing chords on the bass like he would on guitar.
Yes.
No one's playing the guitar solo at all.
No.
There's a couple of good moments of kind of spikiness, if you like, towards the end when his guitar lead starts tangling him up. JJB has a nice pull up. There's a lovely moment as well. Did you see the bit when I think somebody's got their hands on the stage?
Yeah,
and he stamps on it.
Yes.
he's kind of goes to the front and stamps on him. It's kind of nice, but. As ever with Stranglers, although, they're punked up, Dave Greenfield's keyboards are the kind of thrillingly problematic spanner in the works of that.
He's not changing instruments with Jet Black, is he?
No. I mean, and he's always, far too good a player, in a sense, to be a punk. And he always confers this instant 60s-ness to what he plays, not just in the sound of his keyboard, but in the lines and the melodies. But that said... even though it's not as good as Peaches, in the context of this episode of Top of the Pops, this is weird and thrilling. And I think it would have been to any punks or kids tuning in.
Yeah.
This is the moment when that wedges in and when mums and dads are probably talking about sticking them in the army or something.
Yes.
It makes the crowd's reaction kind of inexplicable. I don't think Top of the Pops audiences at this point have figured out how to move to music like this.
No.
Because the inevitable consequence of moving to a record like this is probably something like a mosh pit.
Yeah.
And the Stranglers, unlike the bands that are coming in a few years, they haven't bought their little coterie of fans with them to Top of the Pops.
In an ice cream van.
There's not a couple of hardcore devotees down at the front to show the way. So the crowd's reaction is a little bit odd. But in the context of a pretty, I'm not going to say awful episode of Top of the Pops, but there's been precious little excitement.
Mm.
This is one of the most exciting moments of the show.
Yeah, I don't dislike this record. I mean, it's just a garage punk tune, isn't it? With just enough of an edge left on it to
pass. It's more pub rock than Frankie fucking Miller.
Yeah. But I mean, I'm no fan of the Stranglers, really. But when you look at the pantheon of 77 punk tracks, like the non-heroic ones, that's some pretty floppy competition, really. and the Stranglers are actually up there. Although, like you, I'd rather have Peaches, which is musical trolling, Peaches, it's just a musical shit posting. but I sort of like it because it's like if the Doors were as stupid as they actually were, but knew it. Do you know what I mean? And also, the problem with it being this song is that, is it just me who doesn't like to see groups on Top of the Pops and it's not the usual lead singer singing? Like, I know, it just sets bad bells ringing because of all the A-sides where someone other than the usual lead singer is singing, has there ever been a good one? I can't think of one, ever. I mean, Guns of Brixton wasn't a single, was it?
No.
There's nothing. And I don't count XTC, where the one who wasn't the main singer was better than the one who was the main singer and wrote all the best hits. There must be one. Doesn't really leap out at you, though.
That wasn't a single, was it? Que sera, sera by Sly and the Family Stone.
Right, right, yeah, yeah, yeah.
But it makes sense having JJB as the front person, because before Generation X pitch up, he's the only one who's going to be on the centrefold of Jackie, isn't it?
Yeah, yeah, with his Trotsky T-shirt, which...
Yes, it is.
Had to half cover up, like the Flying Pickets tea towel.
Yeah.
Trotsky still stuck in the number two slot on the commodified communist top 10, behind Che Guevara, the everything I do it for you of Oblivious consumerist irony.
JJB's wearing a T-shirt with the pastiche of the Ford logo, but it says Trotsky.
Yeah.
Yeah, this all started in January of this year when Hugh Cormann was spotted at a gig by the member of the GLC's public committee wearing a Ford logo on his T-shirt that read fuck. GLC went on to force the Rainbow to put a clause in their contract with the Stranglers when they were about to open as support to the Climax Blues Band, which forbade them to either say or wear obscene language on stage. And
wow.
On the night of the gig, Cornwall had the same T-shirt on, which he either chose to wear or he was just living in at the time. And a GLC inspector spotted it from the back of the hall with some binoculars, and they just cut the power on them.
Blimey.
So, yeah, if you'd have been in the know, you'd have been looking at that T-shirt and going, no, they haven't. Oh, I see what they've done there.
Yeah, yeah. Mm.
But they're doing a nice bit of subversion on this episode, as you pointed out, with the swapping of the instruments and the removal of the strings. But also, it appears that the BBC is so preoccupied with T-shirt slogans that they've failed to notice that Burnell's kept in the line, I'm with my friend, with Bob, having a good time. I got me some speed and I'm doing fine.
Yeah.
They probably thought he'd got a motorbike or something.
Yeah, no, exactly.
10 or 15 years earlier, you could definitely imagine them getting away with singing about speed, because the straight and narrow people might think, oh, he must have been prescribed it by his doctor for weight loss or listlessness or a general sense of malaise, you know, trying to mill spantials, but probably not by now. But then again, probably nobody who listened to this with a censor's hat on could understand any of the words, you know what I mean? But the thing is, historically, references to speed do tend to slip past the censor in a way that references to other drugs don't. There's a lot of records that were never banned that are obviously about speed. The Small Faces got away with singing about their dealer.
Yes.
He's always there when I need some speed. At a time when you could get banned from the radio if your song had the word smoke in it, even if you were actually referring to a senior service untipped. You know. Dexys were named after Dexys and had a number one hit whose lyrics helpfully explained what that meant. Yes. Nobody ever banned them. Then if you can't understand what the Stranglers are singing here, good luck deciphering Gino.
I mean, the thing is this punk rock? Probably not. The Stranglers never really were. JJB, he is, though. He's punking it up in his delivery of this song. He's jumping about, like almost like Jimmy Percy or something. And there's a slight discomfort there. It don't feel right in a sec, because it's almost like a cartoon approximation of what punk rock is, I guess. Because they're not quite, and they never do, quite fit in with punk rock. So it's a little forced. But anything, I mean, we've just had fucking Neil Innes singing that song. You know, I mean, anything will do at this point. So it's pretty thrilling to just have a rock and roll band doing what they do. But I would encourage, by the way, people to seek out that demo from 76, because it's totally different. A lot of people, a lot of Stranglers fans prefer it. I don't. But it indicates a kind of process that's going on with the Stranglers, in a sense, that before 77, they had a lot of material.
Yes.
Now they're figuring out ways of punking it up and making it sort of current and making it feel contemporary rather than just being another rock and roll band.
Well, this is the thing about punk. I mean, bands like the Stranglers, they're years behind the curve, and a lot of the punk elite just look down on them because, look, you're too old and you're too proficient. But punk's given them the keys to the charty kingdom, hasn't it? It's like, okay, we'll do these songs, but we'll be arrogant, aggressive bastards that we are anyway. And here we go, into the charts.
Yeah, but I think what I don't like most about the Stranglers, apart from the beer breath ambience in general, is that feeling that they're putting it on or taking it off, you know. You know, they're all about 56 and they could play better than they let on, you know. And I completely understand why older proper musicians would enjoy power and simplicity over anything else, and would find it genuinely refreshing and exciting that suddenly everyone was playing fast and quick. And I just would like it more. if they'd used their experience to create a different way of doing the same thing, rather than doing exactly what a group of untutored 18-year-olds would have done, except they're playing all the right notes. I mean, you know, at this point, they were probably the only punk or punkish band in Britain who could write a song with a hook line based around a circle of fifths. Which is this. And they're almost certainly the only one where you can imagine at least one of the members might know what a circle of fifths is, even though they probably refer to them as the Hey Joe chords, just like everybody else does.
And they're also the only punk-adjacent band who are having no problems getting gigs. They're about to announce their tour, and there's a bit of furore in the local papers, but it's never comes to anything. They never get banned. So, yeah, everything's coming up Stranglers.
But the thing is with the Stranglers, I mean, as Letters to the Music Press kind of reveal, although aligning themselves with punk, they are liked by proper music fans, you know. And that's the thing with the Stranglers. Look, I like the Stranglers, but I know that they are satisfying, whereas the Damned and the Pistols are thrilling. And those are things that Stranglers never really are, you know.
Yeah.
They're satisfying, they're filled out, but they'll never be as thrilling as the great punk records that are coming out this year.
And just before we close, can we just have a little word as usual for Dave Greenfield? They're always the hero of the Stranglers. Never has he looked more inappropriately named than in this clip.
Yeah.
You would believe it if somebody told you that he was something they'd dug up the night before for a laugh and got him moving with puppet strings and electrical charges. And the reason this song is so short is that his jaw keeps dropping off, so they can't take any chances. No, he looks just delightfully half rotten.
He's in a green boiler suit. He looks great.
Yeah, makes him look like someone's just snipped the top of a body bag and just sat him down in front of the keyboard.
Exactly. And also, a quick word for Jet Black, who I do like, because he looks like what he is, a coach driver that you definitely wouldn't want to speak to while the vehicle was in motion. Or afterwards, one word out of place. And
wouldn't like to ask him where the bucket of sand was.
No.
One of your classmates threw up in the aisle.
No, one word out of place and he'd fell you with Richard Burton drunk karate. You ever seen that? It's one of my favourite clips on YouTube when Richard Burton was really drunk, like literally almost dead in the mid-70s. He did this film called The Klansman, where he was in America, like battling the Ku Klux Klan. And there's a clip on YouTube of this where he has to have a fight where this good old boy starts on him and his missus, and he has to kung fu him. But because he's so drunk, he can hardly move. He just has to walk up to him with his fixed grimace with a bright purple face. And then he just kind of raises one flat hand up and the bloke goes, and flies through a window, you know. It's like, you've got to, put it on the playlist.
Of course I will.
Worth a watch.
So the following week, Peaches / Go Buddy Go jumped four places to number 19 and continued its slow pull up the charts, eventually getting to number 8 3 weeks later. The follow-up, Something Better Change, got to number 9 in August, and they'd close out 1977 with No More Heroes getting to number 8 in October, and the LP of the same name getting to number 2 in the same month, held off number 1 by 20 Golden Greats by Diana Ross and the Supremes. Imagine the party that the manager of the Stranglers and the Wurzels has every Christmas. Can you imagine what the buffet's like?
Oh. Lots of finger food.
It's holiday time at the moment, and if you go to Greece and you look for an island called Corilla, you won't find it actually, because it's in the imagination of Demis Roussos. But for the wonders of Top of the Pops, we'll conjure up a lovely island and Demis for you right now.
The winds have changed my roamings and fear. I've seen the things I had to see.
Tony, still alone, reminds us that it's holiday time, but takes the opportunity to warn us about unscrupulous Greeks trying to tempt us towards islands that don't actually exist, as he introduces Kyrilla by Demis Roussos. We first encountered Artemas Venturis Roussos in Chart Music number 35 when he reprised Forever and Ever, which got to number one for a week in July of 1976. And this tune, the follow-up to Because, which got to number 39 in April of this year, is the lead track from the EP of the same name. It's been taken off his recent LP Kirilla, Insel de Trauma, a German-only album, and it, along with a few other tracks, have been Englished up and shoved out for the Bevs and Angers of Albion to slink about to. It's not in the charts just yet, but the BBC are fully expecting it to be so. So while Demis is in the country, they've winched him into the studio.
And what a spectacle.
Oh, it is.
I mean, no expense spared on the holiday vibe from the BBC props department.
No.
What, a couple of palm trees, I think?
Yes.
But it would have impressed me. You know, I mean, the blue caftan would certainly have impressed me, but
yes.
It looks great. I mean, I just think for the longest time as a kid, I was just impressed by Roussos simply because of his size. I mean, much as you know, in the Middle Ages, like, fatness was seen as a signifier of wealth and status and all that.
Yes.
I did look on him not as rotund but a winner, you know, somebody who could presumably have as many goblin burgers and scampi and chips and crisps and pop as he wanted. You know, and of course that contrast between his physicality and his high-fluted sort of John Anderson-style voice provided a bit of novelty value. By this point, 77, he's already well into the kind of being parodied years, you know, the sure sign of making it. Benny Hill and you know, always did him unanimous score. I remember a Freddie Starr routine as well, where Starr was, you know, doing the Demis Roussos song in the higher voice, and then he walks across the stage and suddenly his voice drops, and you notice that behind him there's a bloke with a pair of pliers. So he's getting parodied a lot. I think he is the first solo artist who was born in Africa to get a number one in the UK. I know about Manfred Mann and Freddie Mercury and stuff. It's odd how he's covering this Cameroonian song. The original by It Can Be Brilliant, called Ilongi, is a lot more interesting in its arrangement.
Oh, really?
Yeah, and if you stumble across, by the way, any mid-70s It Can Be Brilliant records, hoover them up, they're great Afro-funk records. But this song, Kirilla, both in its recorded version and in this slightly sloppier iteration by the BBC Orchestra, it's aiming for this kind of, Fernando style world music feel, because he's got a great voice. It kind of works. There is that bring your package holiday home feel to this.
You know, to my mind, it's massively unfair that the Germans heard about this mystical island before us, because, you know, that means they've already got their towels on the best sun lounge. But seeing as Tony has told us that the island doesn't actually exist, that's the Germans fucked, isn't it? That meant a lot in 1977. I mean, 1977 was the year of the fake island, wasn't it? Because, you know, 2 months earlier, The Guardian devoted 8 pages of its April the 1st edition to a supplement on the island of Sansa Reef.
All right.
Which didn't exist either. Yeah, it really went for it. But this song.
Well, there's a question we can ask about a lot of the songs on this episode. What's it doing on this show? It's a non-chart record. Why is that happening? What is it about the Jubilee that has made this happen?
Yeah. And this ain't very Jubilish.
Oh, very much. No, no.
Unless it's for the Queen's husband, of course.
And of course, you know, another question, what the fuck has he got on his feet?
Oh,
lovely. Yeah, shiny red knee boots with a cheeky heel. Basically, it looks like if Superman one day said, oh, to hell with the lot of you. Yes.
Mykonos Agro Boys Kick to Kill.
Yeah, it's this weird combination of platforms and kind of Ronald McDonald shoes.
They're very Pigeon Street, aren't they?
He cuts quite an impressive figure, doesn't he?
Mm.
All round.
Yeah, not so much a dash, more of a gouge, I'd say.
I'm sort of half certain that this is the clip I saw as a kid, actually. Because that stuck in my head. It's exactly how I remember first seeing Demis Roussos. And, you know, I appreciate that in terms of his presentation, he was very much the non-chameleon of pop. But there's something familiar in a very deep way about this particular combination of sound and picture and the fronds. Because he made a mark on a very young me, you know. I was half disturbed and half intrigued by the sound and the look and the movement, the way he always had a fan on him, the foreign sound. And I remember asking my mum, why does he wear those clothes? And she said, because he's so fat. and I got it into my head somehow, linking it in my brain with another clip that had fired my imagination and worried me a little bit, that perhaps Demis Roussos had jumped up and down on the Tacoma Narrows Bridge, and that was what sent it wobbling. And so maybe these two unnerving things were connected. I mean, I didn't actually think that had happened, but in my head, those two things got mixed up to the point where it was all I could think about. And yet here he is, still smiling beatifically, despite having wreaked so much terrible destruction.
Do you know how old he is at the time?
Oh, I'm guessing 36, I'm going to say.
31.
Ooh.
Oh, that changes things. He's not looking great then, is he?
No. But, you know, it's 31 in 1977, Monet.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But, I mean, to me, Demis Roussos, you just saw him and just went, oh, yeah, that's Demis Roussos. You didn't think, oh, my God, look at that enormous fat man.
No, no, no.
You know, there was plenty of people knocking about who looked like Demis Roussos.
Oh, yeah.
Mainly men.
But yeah, yeah, no, the bloke who sold you a brown paper bag full of plums probably looked like Demis Roussos.
Exactly. Yeah.
My only problem is that whenever I hear a song by Demis Roussos that isn't one of the famous or good ones and isn't by Aphrodite's Child, all I can think of is the film L'Ultimo Treno della Notte, also known as Night Train Murders,
right.
And also known as Don't Ride on Late Night Trains. It's a classier offering than most of the don't movies, right? These are instructionally titled horror films, right, which urgently advised us against going into the basement, looking out of the window, going into the house, and so on.
Yeah, but what if you live in the Stockbroker Belt and this film's only on at the West End and you didn't want to bring the car out?
Yeah, yeah,
you're fucked, aren't you?
Good point. But yeah, look, this film is a bit grubby. It's a blatant remake of Wes Craven's Last House on the Left, as acknowledged in the original title, L'Ultimo Treno della Notte, the last train of the night. But the English translators just worked too fast to spot that, you know.
Mm.
Even though Last House on the Left itself was a blatant remake of Ingmar Bergman's The Virgin Spring, which itself is a implausible story that's centuries old, and it doesn't get much more believable when, as in L'Ultimo Treno della Notte, you put it on a train in Europe in the 70s. But incredibly enough, the first thing that you experience when you watch this very unpleasant film, the key events of which are too gruesome to detail even on a broad-minded podcast like this one, and which was actually banned in the UK until relatively recently under the absurd video nasty moral panic laws, which made it a crime to sell or purchase it, and any copy in your possession could be confiscated by the vice squad. It's just a low budget horror film, but the first thing that you hear is the theme song, A Flower's All You Need, by Demis Roussos.
Oh, no.
Co-written by Oscar-winning composer Ennio Morricone.
Fuck.
It gives you some insight into relative British and European attitudes to low-budget exploitation films at the time, even those that are so transparently desperate to shock that the opening scenes show the baddies attacking a department store Father Christmas, which happens more often than you might expect, including in L'Ultimo Treno della Notte. But there he is, singing the theme to this vomit splurge of sexualized violence and elementary emotional switch flicking, the Roussos phenomenon himself, singing this song that goes, tell the world I saw a man fall in the street and die, and just where he fell for love grows a flower, a big red flower like the blood he shed for love and peace.
Wow.
Find a way to live your dreams, you'll make it if you try, for love can't be wrong, your dreams will come true. If you don't want to die before you get a bed of love you never had with your love.
Beautiful words, man.
Right.
Which might seem oddly inappropriate lyrics to any viewer of this film.
Nah.
Although the main refrain goes, sing a song, sing an everlasting song, which does feel quite appropriate when you're listening to it. But the thing is, I might just be showing my ignorance here of middle of the road Greek pop, but that song is almost indistinguishable from this song, at least in my memory. So when I hear this, I subconsciously brace myself in preparation for traumatic sights, which in the context of this episode is actually quite fortunate, as we'll see shortly.
Yeah, I mean, they've obviously got him in early because he's in the country, but, oh, they've served him poorly here, haven't they? They've just got a few trees from fucking Habitat and bunged them in the studio, and they've got some kind of yellow moon and in a blue sky in the background. And, yeah, that's pretty much it. One of the motifs of this episode of Top of the Pops, there's a lot of sweeps of the camera behind things, whether it's trees or bits of the set. So there's times when we don't see anything for about 2 or 3 seconds.
Yeah,
it's like someone stalking Top of the Pops.
And also, I mean, this whole episode feels not like a bodge job, but it's a bit cheapskate, to be honest with you. It's like they've shat all their money. BBC Entertainment budget has just shat it all on that Nationwide...
On
the Nationwide Jubilee special, obviously. But,
of course, yes. Yeah, but well, money well spent. But yeah, I mean, at the time, and even now, Greece might as well be Mars to me and my family, because our holidays were Chapel St. Leonard's, and I think this year we went to Mablethorpe Golden Sands.
Oh, get you.
My nono got an earwig in her ear and turned her half deaf.
Really?
And we got charged 50p for a broken cup, which we hadn't broke. And my mum tried to buy it off them so she could smash it in front of them so they couldn't rip off anyone ever again. I got one of them big cat's head things made of toffee apple. Whatever, to lick on the way back, and I ended up throwing up all over the back of my dad's neck. So, yeah, not the best holiday that year.
Golden memories.
But I wanted to go to Kyriella anyway, because, you know, he's singing about the sky and the sea and all that boring shit. Where's the amusement arcade? Where's the chip shops? Where's the clubs that kids were allowed into where they had blue comedians on? No, mate, not having it. So the following week, Kyriella entered the charts at number 50, then soared 17 places to number 33, but got no further. The follow-up, Life in the City, was given a run out on Top of the Pops in April of 1978, but did fuck all, and he never troubled the charts again. But he remained an endless subject of fascination in the tabloids. Here, chaps, is a tasteful article in the Daily Mirror that doesn't allude to sizeism in the slightest from this November. £30,000 winks in the mink. For Demis Roussos, the glamorous Greek, money is just a big, big yawn. To prove it, the 17-stone singing colossus trundled into a London store yesterday and bought a giant mink-lined bed for £30,000. Gross.
Does it actually say gross?
Yes.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah.
That's £35,000 in today's money. Perhaps even more.
The falsetto-voiced pop star plans to take the Super Bowl, fuck knows what they mean there, on a world warbling tour. And since it measures a jumbo size 8'6" by 8', there should just be about enough room for his pretty 8-stone wife Dominique to climb aboard too. Clearly, they're sure to enjoy setting off on a luxury snooze. That's actually about £142,338 today.
Wow.
On a bed.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
I like how the subtext of that article basically is, but how do they actually do it?
Yes.
And also making it seem as if, you know, when Demis Roussos goes on tour, he has to be like winched into a cargo plane or something to get anywhere.
Yeah.
17 stoner, that's not that much nowadays, is it?
No.
I know, but I mean, these were the days before high fructose corn syrup.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, only pop stars could afford that.
We have two ladies here who, you come from Blackburn, don't you? What a very sensible place to come from. And I'm sure you've had a street party, so why don't we join the party now with Honky?
You know your body is grooving, but you might want to give it a chance.
Tony, Lynette is finally allowed to mix with the maidens of the studio audience, all flick back hair and paper baseball caps that have been pushed back so far they look like cast members of the Young Doctors. He tells us that he has two ladies here, but he only bothers to talk to one of them, as she comes from Blackburn. Presumably the other one lives in Bury St Edmunds, I don't know. He's convinced that they had a street party without even asking if they actually had, and then awkwardly winces at his tenuous link and waits for the video machine to kick in and play Join the Party by Honker. Formed in Southampton in 1975, Honker a fucking honker. This appears to be their debut single on Creole Records and came out in March of this year, catalogue number CR137. The label is orangey brown at the top, with a 50% graduated fade into a goldy colour. Seriously, chaps, that's pretty much the total result of my research on these bastards. I couldn't find anything else.
Yeah. Well, first off, I just want to say something extra about what Tony does.
Oh, please do.
Am I wrong? Did I mishear this? He says Blackburn's a very sexual place. Does he say that?
I think he says a very sensible place.
Does he say sensual? Yes, yeah. It's right on the edge. And he gives this little sort of grimace before it cuts the video, where he realises he might have put his foot in it there.
He's thinking about them 4,000 holes, isn't he?
Yeah. There's a little deflated sort of, and his posture sags.
It does. It's a real sort of, that didn't go well.
But that does set us up nicely for Honky.
Mm. After a couple of months in general circulation, they were drafted in to perform it on Top of the Pops almost a month ago. And 2 weeks later, it entered the chart at number 43, then jumped 12 places to number 31. And this week, it's only moved up one place to number 30. But what does that matter to Robin Nash, who's clearly putting any old shit on this week? So here is a repeat of their previous performance, and fucking hell, the state of it.
Yeah, this is a band that seems to have slipped through a hole in everybody's memory. And as your intro suggests, are now essentially Google-proof.
Mm.
But if nothing else, they do make you sit up.
Oh, yes.
Like ECT. I mean, basically, this is two-man unsound.
Yes.
We have to start off by talking about what they look like, i.e. Yes. breathtaking and horrifying. It's a stage full of misshapen uncles in full flight. Going for the checkered flag. The singer has got a face that makes you think you might need glasses. Or if you wear glasses, a face that makes you want to take them off. His black throat singing is so absurdly exaggerated that
it would have made
Sandy Shaw a bit uncomfortable.
Yeah, it is proper 90s pot noodle advert black voice, isn't it?
Yeah.
Hey, I'll have a baby sham.
And he dances like he's wearing stilts, which is very suspicious, as he also dresses like he's wearing stilts.
Yeah. He's got some massive billowy white Saxons on, hasn't he? Fucking hell.
Yeah, and his constant violent and rhythmic crotch thrust makes you feel like you're being threatened with a licorice comfit. It's not comfortable. Then there's the horn section of Watson, Keegan and Hoddle in the kind of socks people wear in lieu of having a personality.
Yeah, they're mad Catwoman socks, aren't they?
Oh, God, yeah. There's a drummer who looks like the secret brother that John Travolta keeps in the loft. A bass player who actually appears to be Pete Townsend, Brandy edition, in a joke shop wig. A genuinely uncanny and unsettling likeness, but not half as uncanny or unsettling, I think you know what I'm about to say, as the fact that on lead guitar is the Yorkshire Ripper.
Yeah.
Yes.
Hiding in plain sight. Yes. I guess nobody recognised him without the tuxedo and dicky bow or the blanket over his head.
If he'd been driving in a lorry, waving a crisp £5 note.
Yeah, I mean, I know it's not nice, but this can't be ignored. This man beat Dave Lee Travis into second place in a Peter Sutcliffe lookalike contest. Lends a certain visual menace to Honky, which, quite frankly, they were not in need of.
Yeah, the brass line. They just look like a packet of fruit pastels, don't they? They actually look like Hector or any other third division glam band. And it's like, oh, come on, Daddy, get with the programme. It's 1977.
Yeah. I couldn't actually notice much of the rest of the band because the lead singer, his face.
Ray Oven.
I mean, he looks like sort of Brian Tilsley's Klingon brother. and it's, I mean, it's no accident, actually, whilst we're on a sci-fi thing. He also looks like Charles Napier, a.k.a. Adam, the singing leader of the hippie group in the Way to Eden episode of Star Trek. Ooh. But the problem is, I mean, beyond the slight vocal blackface of his, you know, black throat of his vocal, as Taylor's identified with his crotch movements, he's trying to be sexy. And in fact, when he twirls his totally inconsiderable packet in a sort of bawdy simulation of stand-up sex, it inevitably, I mean, perhaps it's just me, but it makes you visualize just horrible stuff. You know, three things for me. One, him looking down at you, grinning maniacally as he plows into the vinegar strokes. Two,
with his lad in his hand, wanting you to degrade yourself.
Yeah, or number two, him looking up at you.
It's a good mental image, pop crazy youngsters. Yeah.
Or him looking up at you as his nasty afro chafes your thighs. Or in a scenario that I must admit I perversely and masochistically spun myself into, him, Andy McCluskey and Roger Daltrey all staring at me in a club, a lascivious leer creeping over their face as they plan to pull the ultimate intercity repellent train on me. He's just vile. He's just vile.
Watch your backs, Neil.
Yeah, Bummer Cerberus.
I mean, the problems start really with the name. I mean, you know, the average shite band. There's this sense in the name.
Yeah, they are Panda Pop's wild cherry, aren't they?
They are. But there's a lot of that about at the time. I mean, just like AWB, they're heading off accusations of cultural appropriation from the off, I guess. But, yeah, you know, what next? White motherfuckers here with their song, you know?
Honke, Taylor, has anyone called you Honke?
No, I've been called a white cunt, which was preferable, really.
I mean, Honky to me means Fingers' girlfriend in Nuts in May.
Oh.
She should have been on the side dancing to this. Hey, Honk, look at them bleeding bluebells. Bleeding millions on them.
There's a fair few artists who called themselves Honky over this. I remember a mid-90s hip-hop troupe called Honky.
Right.
Who did an album called Culture, I think, which was actually fucking ace.
No.
But it's a repeated trick.
It got thrown about at the playground, but it just bounces off, doesn't it?
That was a really frustrating thing, though, Al. You know, as somebody who needed, obviously, words to come back with for stuff that I was called, there weren't many. Honky was one. Bird shit was another.
Oh, that's a good one.
You know, but they weren't satisfying in the way that the racial epithets thrown my way presumably were to the people who said them. I mean, out of the honky songs, you know, actually, you know, inevitably, like Taylor says, they're very Google-proof. And you can find scant sort of tracks by them anywhere. Can't Sit Down was their other single, I think, and that's a better Cool and the Gang ripoff.
Right.
Slightly. I would also, if you get a chance and you're on YouTube and you're intrigued by the honky phenomenon, there's a video called Join the Party TV Television Special 76, which is basically, it's Join the Party, this track, with accompanying visuals. It seems like a home video in a way, which is odd for 76, obviously. It's weird because obviously, you know, they're a funk unit, but they filmed a video like an indie band from the mid 80s. It's all done down the park and they're on swings and there's sort of comedy bits, reverse bits, totally sexist bits as well. They've managed to persuade a couple of dolly birds to dance with them and they occasionally carry them off to the woods in a caveman way. It's actually a really poignant snapshot of something. It's a snapshot of a band who are about to, in a sense, make it. You know, they sell 40,000 copies of this record and they're all necking champagne and stuff. And it's just a nice little slapshot of those times.
Yeah, it's just some Super 8 film edited together to this song. But yeah, for a start, it makes it clear to the point of utter desolation that in mid-1970s Britain, even being a successful pop group could look about as cheerful and glamorous as having your sub post office robbed by Donald Nielsen, the Black Panther. It's all unwashed Wranglers and creosoted garden fences and a plain grey judgmental sky, you know. And And this is the six-week period when Honky were all the rage, yes. You know, yeah. Remembered yeah. by them like it lasted a decade, I'm sure. Mostly spent, I would imagine, drinking warm beer out of small cans in a Artex-ceilinged room at the back of Southampton Polytechnic, yeah. You know, dressed in singlets and dried sweat.
Those cans with a really fucking hard ring pulls to get off.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, two lads with a spiral-bound notebook hanging around saying, "Now, how'd you get the name Honky?" Mm. You know, glory days. Right? That was, I just think that they should actually have called themselves Hanky.
Yes.
Plain, square, tucked out of sight, and then when you retrieve and unfold it, you're staring at the gross waste product of humanity, ready to be swept away in the wash. And the terrible thing is, they're really good musicians, and they're all, they've obviously rehearsed loads and loads and loads, and should they ever have passed through Alberta, Canada, they might reasonably have been able to call themselves the funkiest band in Medicine Hat tonight. But in the grand scheme of things, it's a bit lacking, isn't it? Yeah. There's a bit in this song where he starts to lecture us on what soul is about. Mm. Because when a band can all play this way and are clearly marinated in funk and soul music, and yet sound as stiff and as pale as Honky, there's some explaining to do, you know. This is one of those records that would sound a lot better if it was worse. Do you know what I mean? If it had been this peppy and had this much front, but it was as malformed and broken and semi-functional as their big English faces, you could get with that. That would be interesting. But it's that cellophane layer of slick competence that just seals this up and renders it literally useless.
In 5 years' time, they could have been level 42 and just dressed up as themselves and got on with it, and people would have accepted it. But because it's 1977, if you're playing this kind of music, you've got to try to look the part at the very least and have a jokey name that alludes to your whiteness.
Yeah.
Unlike, say, level 42, who are using funk, I don't know, I'm not saying Mark King was talking about his situation, but there was no attempt to sound American in his vocal,
no,
necessarily.
Exactly.
Whereas this is, this is pure black throat.
Mm.
Yeah, as Taylor says, it's fairly worthless. I think it's been undiscovered, though, of course, by hip hop producers, because it's got a groove.
Yes,
they can summon up a groove, the bass and the drums and everything else. It works, but as a performance, it's actually grotesque.
Yes. I mean, if you're looking for positives, the backing vocals are great. Good work there by the two Pete's. And I like the synth squiggles that they've plastered all over it in a semi-successful attempt to liven the thing up a bit.
Mm.
And good for them that they just did this and then melted away. You know, they weren't like Riot said, Fred. You imagine when I'm Too Sexy came out, if someone said to you, in 30 years' time, they'll still be controversial. Why?
Yeah.
Oh, because of their dangerously arrogant stupidity. Oh, right. Why are they still getting attention? Because of their dangerously arrogant stupidity.
Yeah.
All right, I don't understand this new century. No, neither do we. Right, so Fred have got a new record out, getting play on Mike Reed's Heritage Chart Show.
Of course.
With a cartoon video about how we're all being spoon-fed disinformation by the MSM, like robot sheep, you know. And there's a bit where a TV appears and it says on it, Television.
Oh.
Think about it.
Yeah.
Google Operation Northwoods. Look, this time traveller has a mobile phone in a picture from 1906. You're all so blind. So blind. I bet you don't get any of that from the surviving members of Honky, if any.
No, they just want to throw up videos of their old photos on YouTube when they're stripped at the waist and a bit too close to each other, put the caption, "We weren't gay."
Yes.
Yeah, I know.
Yeah, important. In case, was there in Superdrug today picking up their prescriptions? some homosexuals might rush in and attempt to fuck them up the arse. Yeah.
It's a bit protest too much, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm.
But you know, at the end of the day, they may look like the contents of a crate marked for euthanasia in a section of the Wonderland Zoo that's closed to the public. But at least their only message to humanity was, come on, get up and join the party. Yeah. Them and the late Dr. Goebbels.
It's pretty obvious at this point that Robin Nash is just bunging anything.
Oh, well, yeah.
This is a repeat of a performance from a month ago.
A month?
What's going on, wow. Robin?
It's a rush job, it feels, yeah. This episode at times. It's a rush
it's
job.
It's like, oh, Jubilee, Jubilee, Jubilee. Oh, there's nothing we go. We can't use that. We can't use that. Oh, party. Yes, chuck it in.
Yeah, anyone would think there's a currently popular record in the charts that for some reason they can't use.
So the following week, Join the Party moved up two places to number 28, but would get no further. The follow-up, Give All You Got, failed to chart, and they were never seen or heard of ever again. I'm sorry to say this, pop craze youngsters, but we're going to have to leave you for a bit. But trust me, our hearts are staying right here with you, the pop craze youngsters. So come and join us tomorrow for the thrilling denouement of this episode of Top of the Pops. I'm Al Needham, they're Taylor Parks and Neil Kulkarni, and you are staying pop crazed.
Chart music.